Your headlines for this hour: the Yemeni army says it has targeted another American ship in the Gulf of Aden with appropriate naval missiles in support of the people of Gaza. The Iraqi Prime Minister once again calls for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country, saying it is crucial for Iraq's security and stability. And the UN human rights expert slams Israel's measures in Gaza as a violation of international law, describing them as highly illegal and highly unlawful. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Today's top story: the Yemeni army says it has carried out another operation against an American vessel navigating through the Red Sea. Spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Yahya Sari, said in a statement that the operation took place in the Gulf of Aden with appropriate naval missiles, resulting in a direct hit. Sari reaffirmed that marine traffic in the Arab and Red Seas will continue to all destinations around the world except for ports in the occupied Palestinian territories. He also warned that the recent attacks on Yemen by the United States and the UK will not go without response and unpunished. Sari said Yemen's operations are in support of the people of Gaza amid Israel's genocidal war. He stressed that operations against ships owned by or bound for Israel will continue until the Israeli onslaught and siege of Gaza end. Political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti joined us earlier from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. He says the fact that the Yemeni army has attacked two U.S. ships after Washington designated Ansarullah Movement as a terrorist organization is a clear sign that anti-Israeli operations will intensify and will soon include the U.K.'s ships.
Designation of the United States here in Yemen, they don't care about that, but they are honored to have that relisting as a terrorist organization because we know, and as Sayyid Abdul Malik have said, United States is just the face of the crime. United States is one of the countries that have destroyed, have destruction wherever they go. So we are honored to be designated as terrorist because, as always they say, one man terrorist is another man freedom fighter. And I just want to add that there are three ships that United States owned ship that has been targeted. Two of them was after this relisting of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization, and there's a clear message that here in Yemen they actually will not stop their attack, but they will continue their attack against Israeli-linked ship or Israeli-owned ship or ships going toward Israel. And Sayyid Abdul Malik have said today that as well, British ship will come under attack. And as Yahya Sari, the spokesperson of Yemeni army, have said in his statement that the retaliation of the attack on Yemen by the United States and UK, it will and it's still to come.
The Iraqi Prime Minister has reiterated his government's opposition to the presence of U.S. forces in the country. Mohammad Shia al-Sudani says American troops must leave as Daesh is no longer a threat to Iraq.
The reasons for the presence of coalition's forces were to confront Daesh. Today, the security situation, to the testimony of all specialists in Iraq and friends, Daesh does not pose a threat to the Iraqi state. Today, after the repercussions and attacks on the Iraqi security headquarters, we have the right to start this dialogue immediately in order to reach an agreement on arranging a timetable for the end of the mission of international advisors.
Sudani was addressing a panel discussion at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss city of Davos. He said ending the U.S. military presence is crucial for Iraq's security and stability. His remarks came as U.S. bases in Iraq have been repeatedly attacked by Iraqi resistance groups over Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. In response, the U.S. military has launched attacks on Iraq's popular mobilization units, killing a number of their members. The Iraqi government has slammed the U.S. attacks as a violation of the country's sovereignty. Last year, Sudani vowed before the Iraqi parliament to put an end to the U.S. military presence in the country. Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst from Verschaire, Vermont. Mr. Halali, welcome. Now, Mr. Halali, as we know, Daesh was defeated in November 2017 with the then commander of the Quds Force of Iran's IRGC, the late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, declaring the end of the group's terror in the region. Now, General Soleimani and the deputy of Iraq's PMU, as we know, Commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, were assassinated in a drone strike outside Baghdad Airport in 2020. Now, days later, Iran's parliament voted for the departure of U.S. forces. So that was in 2020, 4 years ago. So the question is, what was or is the holdup?
I think, of course, the holdup is the pressure by the United States on Iraq. It's the question of one of sovereignty. Of course, the United States respects no one's sovereignty. And as we all well understand, the issue here is that the Iraqi parliament, as you rightfully said, after the assassination of General Soleimani and General Mohandes, we have this situation where the Iraqi parliament has voted for the U.S. to leave Iraq, and the U.S. within 4 years and continuing on has not left. And even now the Iraqi president al-Sudani is saying you need to leave, and they're not leaving. And so of course it shows the disregard by which the United States holds governments that they are that they consider below them, that they are subservient to them. And the same is true across the border in Syria, where the United States has forces illegally there. When the government in Damascus, President Bashar al-Assad has asked for the U.S. to go, they won't go. So it's a question of one of imperialism, one of Orientalism, and seeing, of course, these countries as vassals of the United States.
Mr. Halali said that there are still around 2,500 U.S. troops stationed in Iraq. So what is the U.S.'s real intentions of staying in Iraq 7 years after the defeat of Daesh? And also your thoughts on analysts saying that the U.S. presence is actually causing more instability in the region.
There is no doubt in my mind that the U.S. presence is causing instability. That is a fact. And we recognize that and we know that because everywhere the U.S. goes, they bring with them destruction, coup d'etats, color revolutions, and so on and so forth. The main idea here for us to analyze is why the U.S. has stayed after all of these years since the defeat of Daesh. And we recognize and we can understand that the reason isn't about Daesh. The reason isn't about Iraq. The reason is ultimately about Iran. The reason is to have a military position close enough to the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the United States can continue to project its power. And of course, we know from the former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, that the United States has been funneling arms and equipment to various terrorist entities across the border into Iran, and has been funding and training and promoting terrorist organizations that seek to overthrow the Islamic Republic, like the terrorist organization, the Mujahideen Khalq in Albania. So, of course, we recognize that the U.S. being there is one to project its aims at Tehran. It has nothing to do with anybody else in the region.
Thank you, Mr. Halali. It's always good talking to you. Mr. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst from Vermont, Verschaire. Thank you, sir. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, a U.S. military drone has been shot down in northern Iraq while flying close to the border with Iran. According to earlier reports, the MQ-9 Reaper drone was shot down near the Iraqi city of Muqtadiyya in Diyala province. The unmanned aerial vehicle had reportedly taken off from the U.S. Air Force's Ali al-Salem base in Kuwait. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack yet. The development came amid heightened tensions and simmering anti-American sentiments across the region. During the recent months, Iraqi resistance forces have carried out attacks on American bases, both in Iraq and neighboring Syria, on an almost daily basis. The attacks took place in response to U.S. support for the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza. Earlier this week, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired a barrage of missiles at an espionage center of the Israeli spy agency Mossad in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. One of those killed in the operation was a Kurdish multimillionaire oil tycoon, Peshro Majid Agha Dizai. Now, photos obtained by Press TV establish his Mossad connections and how he was a vital cog in the Israeli spy agency's operations in the Iraqi Kurdistan, mainly against Iran. One of the photos shows Desai, who had close ties with Mossad, with a Zionist rabbi at an event held to celebrate the Jewish festival on Yom Kippur. Another photo shows him beside Mossad agent Elan Nassim, as well as Hossein Yazdan Panah, the commander of an anti-Iran terrorist group. According to informed sources, Elan was a key Mossad officer who coordinated the agency's operations in Iran and the Iraqi Kurdistan. The sources say Elan was also killed in the IRGC attack, along with four other members of his espionage team. Desai had made a fortune from illegal export of Iraqi oil to the Tel Aviv regime. He also headed the Falcon Group conglomerate with business interests in security, oil, gas, construction, and agriculture. 105 days into the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip, and the regime continues with its carpet bombing campaign across the besieged territory. The total death toll has now passed 24,600, with nearly 62,000 others wounded. Israel has lately stepped up its strikes on the southern areas in the Gaza Strip. Gaza's health ministry says the occupation has committed 15 massacres against families in the Gaza Strip, killing 172 people in a span of 24 hours. The ministry says that a number of victims are still under the rubble and in blocked streets that ambulance crews and civil defense personnel cannot reach. This as communications and internet services are completely cut off in wide areas of Gaza for the seventh time since October the 7th. Highly illegal, highly unlawful. That's how a UN human rights expert describes measures taken by the Israeli regime in the besieged Gaza Strip. The UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories slammed the relentless Israeli bombardment of highly crowded areas in Gaza as a violation of international law. Francesca Albanese said the regime used 6,000 bombs per week during the first 2 weeks of his aggression alone. She added that a good number of Gaza's hospitals have been closed, bombed, or taken over by Israel. The UN official said the number of kids who lose one or two limbs in Gaza every day is shocking. Albanese said during the first 2 months of Israeli onslaught, 1,000 kids underwent amputations without anesthesia, describing it as a monstrosity. Israel is currently facing a genocide case at the International Court of Justice for crimes it has committed in Gaza. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. John Philpott, international human rights lawyer, all the way from Montreal, Canada. Mr. Philpott, welcome. Now, the US-backed Israeli regime is committing these atrocities under the pretext of self-defense. Now, my question is killing civilians, as we've witnessed, nearly 25,000 people have been killed, with around 10,000 of them being children. Is this a new kind of self-defense? And also, bearing in mind that many analysts are saying what happened on October 7th, was the real self-defense by the Gazans against an apartheid regime imposing their will on Palestinians on their rightful lands for more than seven decades now?
Well, I'll start with the last comment you made. And Mr. Morandi of Iran has talked about it as being a jailbreak. And what happened on the 7th was an amazing military effort. We don't know. What maybe something went wrong, we don't know. We know Israel practiced the policy of killing their own hostages. And so I'm not going to comment on the legality or not, because we don't know the facts. Obviously, the people in a jailbreak still have to respect civilians, but that's not the issue, because whatever Hamas did, what Israel has done over the last 105 days, you said, is 1,000 times worse. It's immeasurably worse, and it's done from a position of power and with a real intent. And Mrs. Albanese has done made a very good statement on this. I think it's important to understand the right of self-defense of Israel does not exist. Israel is an occupying power of Gaza, and it has to defend the rights of the people living in Gaza, has to defend their right to education, to food, to water. And all the human rights that every human being wants, education, Israel has the obligation under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Now, the right to self-defense, I'm going to give a specious example because it's absurd. If Russia attacked Iran, Iran could fight back against Russia by all means necessary to defend itself against Russian aggression under Article 51 of the Charter of the UN, which is kind of normal. Now, this is obviously not a real example, but this is how international relations are defined. So Israel is not, Gaza is part of Israel in the sense it's occupied by Israel, and Israel has an obligation to defend and protect these 2.2 million, I think it is, people of all their human rights, education, and I'm not going to repeat it because I just stated that. So this Western concept, puppeted by Justin Trudeau of Canada, Israel's a right to defend itself, is nonsense in law. And the 2004 decision of the International Court of Justice on the illegality of the wall, which they did to separate and kind of accentuate the apartheid system. There's many other aspects of the apartheid, of course, clearly stated that Israel has an obligation to defend under the Fourth Geneva Convention. So that's part of it. Then, even if Israel has a right to defend itself, which is nonsense, in the war, theoretical war against Hamas, they cannot attack civilians the way they do it. They are attacking civilians, infrastructures. They're telling people to move from one area to another, and then they're attacking them where they run away to. So the execution of their wall, of their defense, which I don't accept, also violates all basic law, because you have heard they are committing genocide.
Mr. Philpott, thank you, sir. It's always nice talking to you. There you have a Mr. John Philpott, international human rights lawyer from Montreal, Canada. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
US President Joe Biden has faced a barrage of criticism from lawmakers on Capitol Hill over his decision to launch airstrikes together with Britain against Ansarullah targets in Yemen without congressional approval. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsweek magazine has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. President Joe Biden risked losing support from Muslim voters during the November 2024 election after he ordered strikes on Yemen in support of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. President Biden ordered airstrikes on several provinces across Yemen, including Yemen's capital Sana'a and the port city of Hodeidah, early on Friday, 12th of January, in response to the Yemeni pro-Palestine strikes on vessels linked to the Israeli regime. Together, the U.S. and the British military carried out the airstrikes on Yemen. Citing its interviews with activists and community members, Newsweek said airstrikes in Yemen launched under orders of President Joe Biden appear to be another nail in the coffin for Arab and Muslim voters. Edward Ahmed Mitchell, Deputy Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, told Newsweek on Friday, 12th of January, that the civil rights group is deeply disturbed by the illegal airstrikes in Yemen, slamming the Biden administration for failing to address the root causes of the tensions in the Red Sea. Edward Ahmed Mitchell said, "We're deeply disturbed to see the Biden administration escalating this crisis by bombing Yemen without congressional approval, instead of simply addressing the root causes of this crisis, which is the ongoing war in Gaza. If the genocide in Gaza comes to an end, the temperature in the region will come down." Edward Ahmed Mitchell added, "From our perspective, this strike has done without congressional approval is illegal. It's dangerous, and ultimately it's not going to bring peace to the region. It's simply going to escalate the tensions and bring more war." Mitchell believes that many people are disturbed that our government is quick to protect commercial shipping, but not quick to protect thousands of children who are being murdered in the Gaza Strip. Newsweek magazine has reported that a coalition of Muslim Americans have gone as far as launching an Abandon Biden campaign, calling on voters to not re-elect President Biden this year because of his stance in the war in the Gaza Strip. Newsweek cited Wael al-Zayat, the chief executive officer of Engage, as saying, "I think President Biden's standing with Arab and Muslim voters has already suffered tremendously because of his Israel-Palestine policy and his unconditional support for Netanyahu, despite mounting evidence of war crimes and possibly genocide in Gaza." Wael al-Zayat added, "We're hearing from Muslim Arab voters that they're extremely unhappy, disappointed, and many are saying, as of right now, based on what they have seen, they will not be voting for Joe Biden." Opinion polls also showed a decline in Biden's popularity among Muslim American voters. According to a survey released by Engage in early November of 2023, only 5.2% of Muslim Americans it sampled said they would vote for Biden in the upcoming presidential election. According to a survey conducted by a polling firm, Change Research, on behalf of Engage and the Muslim American non-profit organization, Muslim Public Affairs Council, this marks a steep decline from the 86% of Muslim Americans who voted for Joe Biden in 2020. The strikes on Yemen were also slammed by Jill Stein, a candidate for the Green Party's nomination in the 2024 presidential race. Jill Stein said the U.S. is now risking serious escalation. Stein explained, "It's not only Muslim Americans who are horrified by this, so too are young people and many in our communities of color. In fact, a landslide majority of U.S. voters want a ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the genocidal war there, much of it paid for by American tax dollars." However, Congress and the White House are listening to AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the war profiteers instead of the American people. Jill Stein explained, "There is growing movement to use the power of democracy to demand our elected officials listen to us and not to the lobbyists, to the super PACs and big campaign donors. Specifically, people are pledging not to support pro-genocide candidates in the upcoming election and to give their support to candidates working for a ceasefire and an end to occupation, apartheid and genocide." Jill Stein said, "Joe Biden's response to the conflict in West Asia further undermines the confidence and support of the American people, contributing to the continuing downward slide of his poll numbers." The Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. U.S. President Joe Biden has faced a barrage of criticism from lawmakers over his decision to launch airstrikes together with Britain against Ansar Allah targets in Yemen without congressional approval. The United States and Britain, backed by Bahrain, Australia, Canada and the Netherlands, struck more than 60 targets at almost 30 locations in Yemen on Friday, 12th of January, martyring at least 5 Yemenis and injuring 6 others. Several cities across Yemen were hit, including the capital Sana'a and the western Yemeni port city of Hodeidah. The Ansar Allah stronghold of Sa'da and the southwestern city of Damar were also hit. The strikes were met with immediate condemnation from progressive lawmakers on Capitol Hill who said the raids violated the Constitution because President Biden did not seek congressional approval. Rashida Tlaib, the sole Palestinian-American member of the U.S. Congress, said on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, that President Biden was violating Article 1 of the Constitution by carrying out airstrikes in Yemen without congressional approval. Rashida Tlaib added, "The American people are tired of endless war." Congresswoman Pamela Jayapal, a Washington Democrat and the chair of the Progressive Caucus, echoed Rashida Tlaib's message, calling the strikes an unacceptable violation of the Constitution. Pamela Jayapal wrote on X, "Article 1 requires that military action be authorized by U.S. Congress." The swift condemnation from lawmakers was echoed by immediate protests in Washington and New York. Demonstrators were seen outside of the White House on Thursday evening, 11th of January, chanting, "Let Yemen live and hands off Yemen." Outside the Progressive Democrats, other lawmakers joined the opposition to the airstrikes, including Democrat Rohana, Republican Congressman Thomas Massey, and Republican Senator Rand Paul. Many of the lawmakers who opposed the strikes were previously signed legislation seeking to end measures giving the president extended authority to wage war abroad, including during the Donald Trump administration when lawmakers passed a war powers resolution specifically for Yemen. Republican Congressman Thomas Massey said on X, "The United States has been involved in hostilities in Yemen in one form or another for over 5 years now. The sad reality is Congress frequently refuses to assert its authority."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma, your service as the host. And in here, we're going to have an amazing episode today. Well, before I start and introduce the guests, I would love to offer my warmest wishes to all the mothers all around the world. Thank you for all of you to be in this very world. If the mothers were not in here, then life would have been so dull and so depressing. So thank you. And so, assalamu alaikum, sister. By the way, today, Sister Shamali is our friend, and she's going to help us with more of women. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum to you and to everyone else who's listening to our program.
Of course. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
As the ritual of this program, we would love you to have a very brief introduction about yourself.
I have studied in the Seminary for Women in Qom for a couple of years, and I'm now a PhD candidate in the field of women's right in Islam in university.
Thank you very much. Well, let's just start it this way. Since you are women's experts, let's put it this way, that I have been befriending too many girls who are doing different jobs, and at the same time they have this responsibility of being a wife and a mother, and then they study, they do jobs, and they can manage it all together. Honestly speaking, when I see them from the outside, I just feel like mesmerized. How could they do it all together? For sure, there's a history to this, women's occupation, how they can do all these multitasking sort of thing, which is so difficult and seems like a drudgery. Let's talk more on that.
You're absolutely right. I don't know if it's actually a good idea to have women juggle between work and household chores, you know, expecting a woman to be a superwoman and, you know, do everything. Well, that's another topic. But with regards to your question of historically talking about women's occupation, we can say that in the 17th century, when the Industrial Revolution was beginning to emerge,
yeah,
and people's lifestyles was changing, because previously a person's workplace was very near, you know, nearly situated to his home, his or her home.
Yeah.
And families were extended, and they were able to manage all their needs, you know, to meet all their needs within the confinements of their their house,
yeah,
or
yeah,
very near it. Like, they had farms, or they raised cattle, they grew their own eggs and crops, and they had their own cheese and eggs and fur, and the women stitched their own clothes, like the clothes of the family.
Like they were colonies doing their own things with themselves.
Every family was not exactly completely, but to a large extent, independent of other sectors of the society.
Yeah.
It was like self-sufficient, right?
Exactly.
This continued until cities began to emerge, large cities and factories and industries. And little by little, people were drawn from villages to cities for in search of a better job and, you know, more money. So what happened was that men usually went to occupy these places, and money became a commodity, like money was within the hands of people, and little by little people were saving up more, and being able to purchase property.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So wealth began to go to the hands of men, whereas before, where families were run by, you know, man and woman within a household and, you know, taking care of their farms.
Simultaneously, yeah.
Yeah, they both did the task of taking care of all the chores. And it wasn't like, hey, I earned the money, I'm the breadwinner, you're staying at home.
Yeah.
They were working together, right? But when men went to factories, women were like mostly looked upon as consumers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, a lot of the needs of the family was met outside. For example, someone else made, there was a textile factory, like there was a big farm raising, you know, little by, just like look at our life in this time, where like, even when you want to, like everything that you have is made outside.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You eat processed cheese, the egg, you get it from outside. You do nothing.
Everything is prepared outside. You have just to earn the money and go get it.
Exactly. And even when one day there is no internet connection and you can't pay online, you're crippled.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. When this happened, women felt that, hey, men are getting in possession of wealth and they're buying property and house and they have no role to play.
Exactly.
And besides this, at the same time, people, you know, like, you know, that in the Greek philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy, there was a big difference between a male and a female. They thought of the male as the one owning intellect, wisdom, and, you know, someone who knows how to make the right decision without having his emotions involved in like the decision-making process, whereas the woman was considered to be the emotional one. And you have to see what like
the destroyers based on their mythologies.
Exactly.
Women are the Pandora's box.
Yeah, and there were so many negative words I've heard from like the ancient Greek philosophers where they say women are evil. All the evil inclinations in the world,
yeah,
they come from women at the age of enlightenment,
yeah,
after the Dark Ages. And the intellect of a person began to take prominence,
yeah,
in a society and in people's lives. And people were beginning to think that, hey, we can manage to do everything. Well, of course, I'm talking about the extreme of this.
I know. Yeah, I get it. We came to an age in which everybody thought that, all the women, I mean, they thought that they were consumers and it was like a bingo moment for them. So they started to change their ideology about themselves and about their roles. And right at this moment, we have to go for a short break and then we'll be back. So usually the greatest changes in history happen with a moment that people will start to think deeply. And the same thing happened to women as well. And yes, you're listening to Muslim Ladies. Sister Shamali is in here and I'm at your service. Well, this is Asma and we're talking about women and what happened for them to change their perspective about themselves and suddenly come into the society as one of the main ingredients.
I just want to introduce a book for you. The book that I'm using right now is Feminist Thought, A Comprehensive Introduction, published in 1989. It's done by Rosemary Tung. And she actually talks about the different figures and personalities in feminism and analyzes them and, you know, gives her own opinion on and her own understanding of all these,
yeah,
happenings. So we were saying previously that at the age of enlightenment, intellect and wisdom became something very prominent. And little by little, they were saying that, okay, whatever, the only one thing, the only character that distinguishes an animal from a human being is intellect. So, and so women are also humans.
Intellectual beings.
Exactly. Therefore, they're intellectual beings.
Yeah.
So if men and women have the potential to use ethics and intellect to the fullest and flourish this potential in themselves, they need education.
Yeah.
Prior to that, education was something that was usually dedicated to boys and men, right?
Exactly.
But because of the conclusion that women are also as intellectual as boys and
as
men,
yeah.
So education was the right of women as well.
Mm-hmm.
An equal education. This is exactly when feminism began to emerge, and they were saying that, okay, the whole society, the whole world is dominated by men power, by masculine power, and we want equal rights. Why? Because we're as human as you are. We have as much intellect as you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, but they began to say that, okay, so we will give you the right to education. But they were not satisfied. They were not happy enough. They said, after that, we want to have equal chance as you to work and to be responsible in the gains and loss of businesses,
yeah,
and everything that went on in the society.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
After the Industrial Revolution, again, because this patriarchal ideology is dominant, they thought that, okay, now, because, you know, different sort of diseases came in the way, so the number of the slaves who were men were reduced. Therefore, to make up for that, to compensate for that, they brought up women into industry by the slogans that, okay, you must have the same right as men do. Therefore, they brought women into the industrial background as well.
Exactly. That is one very important point that you mentioned, because, you know, what I'm saying is just sheds light on specific aspect of the historical look on women's education,
yeah,
occupation. There are so many other variables and aspects that play a role in this game. So what you mentioned is totally right. And to be honest, the capitalist forces that were, you know, emerging in the,
yeah,
societies, they wanted the production of more, they wanted more profit, and more profit entailed more and more production.
Exactly.
And more production entailed more and more consumption, right?
Yeah.
So, like, the disease of our age, which is consumption, has its roots at the same time that industrialism came into power, right?
Mm-hmm.
With capitalism.
Yeah.
So, women were very, very good individuals to persuade them, to make them believe, to make them decide that they need more and more.
Exactly.
Right?
The target of consumerism are mostly women.
Exactly. Because they're the ones who use makeup products.
Fashion.
Fashion industry.
Yeah.
Clothes, shoes, purses, bags, everything. Like, our grandmas, they had like a handful of dresses. Like maybe
exactly.
5-6 dresses for all their occasions. Like very limited amount of
exactly, yeah,
clothes.
They were not that much into this fashion thing.
Not at all. And they themselves were the ones who stitched it. And like, I remember
embroideries and
everything.
The things they did with their hands.
Exactly. And like, for example, our mothers, whenever like their parents made them a piece of clothes, the elder sister wore it, then the second one, then the third,
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it was passed down to the other generations.
Exactly.
As well.
This is the opposite of consumerism.
Exactly.
And so to have all this world of the capitalist world running, women had to come in the forefront.
Yeah, and that was the very beginning of their emergence in society. Of course, it's not bad to have women in society, but at the same time, as you are going to cover it, they targeted the house and the families, and this very, you know, the warm center of a home is a mother. So when you take her to the society, many things would change. And we cannot ignore the very fact that mothers are mostly excluded from the centers of the families. And that's not a good and very happy thing to happen. So thank you, sister.
Thank you.
I myself have enjoyed it very much. Still, going through this historical study of women is a very interesting thing, because that would enlighten us more and more. We'd open, and it's the thing that would open up our eyes more and more and make us know the goals, the purposes, and the ways of this world. So thank you very much, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Fourth Geneva Convention obligates an occupying power to ensure that proper medical supplies are provided and that hospitals and health services are maintained in the territory under occupation. The Zionist regime is doing the exact opposite. It is subjecting healthcare to collective punishment so that Palestinians are tortured, displaced, and killed. The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Though not defined formally in international human rights law, the term medical apartheid has been used to describe similar situations of pervasive segregation and discrimination in healthcare based on race, and characterized by stark inequalities in healthcare accessibility, availability, and quality. The Zionist regime has been hampering the development of, destroying, and openly targeting the Palestinian healthcare system. The system was built and supported mainly by international donors." Strategically, the Zionist regime made Palestinian healthcare dependent on aid. Over the years, Israel has been attacking health facilities, medical workers, and ambulances in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has repeatedly attacked hospitals and medical centers in order to push people out of Gaza. It has caused a scarcity of medical supplies, fuel, and necessities such as food and water for the same purpose. The estimated 800,000 people who remained in northern Gaza after the Zionist regime's evacuation orders have been left without any health care apart from some failed medical points that cannot provide anything beyond first aid. Hospitals have been put out of service after the Zionist regime attacked them, threatening the lives of patients, displaced people, and healthcare personnel. The same steps are being taken in southern Gaza. The Zionist regime is now carrying out ethnic cleansing against Palestinians by wiping out the basics of life in the south. That includes healthcare infrastructure. The scale of human losses is enormous. Survivors have been left with no choice but an exodus. The underlying problems, de-development and destruction of healthcare, started a long time before October 7th. For almost 17 years, the blockade has meant that Gaza's healthcare system cannot function properly. The health ministry has been unable to provide sustainable services. The Zionist regime has deliberately restricted access to medicines and essential equipment such as medical imaging devices. Israel has prevented the entry of X-ray and other scanning machines and spare parts based on claims that they can be used both for civilian and military purposes. By February 2022, Israel had approved only 30 out of 120 requests submitted by the Palestinian Authority in 2021 for the entry of such equipment into Gaza. Under siege, Gaza has not been able to devote the resources needed for training and recruiting specialized staff. That has undermined the capacity of hospitals to offer specialized services such as oncology, nephrology, cardiology, and advanced surgeries. Moreover, patients who require specialized care frequently cannot access it outside Gaza. Restrictions on movement have condemned many to deaths that were preventable. In 2021 alone, more than 36% of applications for permits to receive treatment outside Gaza were either refused or left unanswered. According to the 4th Geneva Convention, hospitals, clinics, ambulances, and their staff are protected at all times so they can freely treat the wounded and sick. Attacks against them are war crimes and violations of international law. Over the years, the Zionist regime has faced no consequences for its attacks. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has attacked more than 140 health institutions, putting 23 hospitals and 53 medical centers out of service. The Zionist regime has killed more than 300 healthcare workers, some with a huge amount of experience. Many have been attacked at home with their families or while on duty. Such attacks are clearly assassinations. Their aim is to deprive Gazans of any hope of being saved or treated. The ground invasion enabled the Zionist regime's forces to meticulously select their targets among medical staff after besieging hospitals or blocking the roads used by ambulances. The Zionist regime has abducted approximately 100 healthcare workers. They include Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, director of Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, and Dr. Akram Hussein, head of the surgery department at Gaza's Indonesian hospital. Worsened by the ground invasion, the obstruction of ambulances is becoming a more commonly practiced tool of medical apartheid. The wounded are left to bleed to death without help. In addition to this overt destruction, the Zionist regime has engineered a public health crisis. Israel's actions have led to the rapid spread of illnesses such as diarrhea, scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rash, hepatitis A, and upper respiratory infections. The disruption of vaccination programs, overcrowding at shelters, and winter weather exacerbate the problems. Similarly, the tightening of blockades since the war began, and particularly the restrictions on the entry of essential medical supplies, has led to a surge in deaths that could have been prevented. Until now, more than 9,000 people are reported to have died during the war because hospitals lacked resources and supplies and could not conduct operations. These include patients who died from infections and birth in humane circumstances. They also include patients with chronic diseases who have not been able to find medicines. The effects of continuous bombardment on mental health is just as profound as the physical effects. Yet, mental health services remain grossly inadequate, exacerbating the suffering. According to reports, more than 60% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed in the current war. Universities, factories, governmental buildings, and hospitals have been attacked. All this violence makes it impossible to provide the services necessary for life and impacts the livelihoods and mental health of Gaza's people. The destruction and displacement which the Zionist regime is causing appears to be a strategic move to make Gaza unlivable. Gazans are being pushed to leave Gaza. This approach is reminiscent of ethnic cleansing, as UN experts have noted. Urgent action is imperative to end the war, lift the blockade, and ensure the free flow of essential supplies and skilled professionals to Gaza. Rebuilding healthcare infrastructure and giving comprehensive support are crucial steps to mitigate the devastating effect of the Zionist regime's war on Gaza.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.